Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Anna Brailman, who is a lecturer at Liverpool Hope in psychology, and they do research on beauty. So what we find beautiful and why we find it beautiful, but looking at this computationally. So looking at computational models of how we can understand how we experience beauty, which I think is so cool. I didn't think was possible because obviously beauty and art is very subjective. So hearing about how it can be understood in this way, I think is awesome. And we'll hear about how these models actually work and then how they could also be helpful for ways we understand things clinically as well. So this was a really cool episode and I hope you guys enjoy.
My name is Anna Brailman. I'm a psychologist by training and I study how people experience beauty from various experiences, but mostly from seeing things.
And so your research looks at aesthetic value and beauty. So can you explain what this is and how you can define it in science? Because I think people, they might be like, oh, can you actually study these things in science?
Absolutely. That question came up a lot during my PhD work when I started at this. So let me start off by beauty and giving a definition of that, because that seems to me the word that everybody uses in everyday life. So for me, based on my research, beauty is a peak pleasure experience that we have in response to any sort of sensory experience. So that can be a visual impression. That can also be music or sounds in general. So that is beauty to me. Really simple. Peak pleasure response in response to a sensory experience. Aesthetic value is tough to define. And I think the best way of doing it is actually taking it apart. Aesthetic, the first bit. I personally have a very broad definition of that that goes back to a German philosopher, Alexander Baumgart. He coined that term, and what he meant by it was based on any sort of sensory experience. So I'm readopting this. Anything that's aesthetic to me is simply something that results from us having a sensory experience via sight, sound, touch, taste. Value, I'm also borrowing the definition pretty much. This time around, not from philosophy, but from scientists who study reward learning and economists as well. And basically value means that we are willing to exert any form of effort to achieve an experience or to achieve a certain reward. That is how value is defined. It's basically the trade value. That sounds sort of logical, but the amount of effort or other kinds of rewards of money we are willing to spend on an experience. So taken together, then aesthetic value to me is the trade value we assign to a sensory experience.
So that then wouldn't have to be, it gets so complicated, doesn't it? Because that wouldn't have to be necessarily quote unquote good experience, because like you go to see a horror movie, you would like, I was just thinking that's the first thing that came to mind.
Horror movies are incredibly interesting examples of having aesthetic value, because intuitively there's no pleasure per se associated with them. But that shows also that a definition of value in terms of not necessarily pleasure, but rather what you're willing to pay for it is pretty handy, because obviously people do value horror movies, myself included, and they are willing to spend the time and potentially the money to actually see them. What myself and colleagues, especially Paul Bloom, believe is happening with these horror movies is that we get both out of them, both pleasure and displeasure. So while we are afraid based on the content of it, we might still get pleasure out of how that content is being presented. So surface and presentation might still induce pleasure, while content and semantics produce fear or anger or any other kind of negative emotion.
Yeah, I see. So it's, yeah, of course, it's not like just a horror movie just gives you one set of emotion. Yeah, it's like a whole lot of them, and that could, yeah, that That makes sense. That's interesting. I didn't realize that was going to be the definition of aesthetic value. So my mind's, oh my God. So how, it's funny, when I've been speaking about this episode already with people, they're like, but wait, how can you research beauty with quantitative and computational methods when beauty feels like such a subjective thing?
That is an amazing question. I love that this came up. And it comes down to two very important things in my research. One of them being that I very rarely look at population averages, which is unusual for psychologists. So very often we need to collapse data from many people into one aggregate value. And then we draw conclusions about the general population from those values across people. I can't do that because beauty is very subjective. That I find beautiful, you might find very ugly. So I usually look at the data from individual people one by one. What I'm trying to find is not an average image that is beautiful to every person, but I'm trying to study the mechanics, so the process via which everybody gets to find something beautiful. And a thing in and by itself can be something very different. So to give you an example, what I'm focusing on right now is a balance between novelty and familiarity. That in and by itself is defined differently for every person. What is novel to me might be already familiar to you. However, the overall formula of how much novelty and how much familiarity you want to have in order to find something beautiful might be the same. So by that route, we can not circumvent, but we can still find general rules that apply to everybody, despite beauty as an experience being super subjective.
This might be the wrong example, but this is just what came to mind with the novelty and if something's familiar. So I live in Australia and I have people from overseas come and see the beaches, and I find the beaches beautiful, but there's definitely a thing where my friends see them for the first time and they're just like really blown away. Like the beauty is really too much. Would that be an example of that kind of trade-off?
Absolutely. I think this trade-off is present in many different kinds of experiences. And I think that is a brilliant example.
Yeah, that's really cool. So now we're going to talk about some of your papers. So one of your papers explored an idea by Kant that said that beauty requires thought, while sensuous pleasures don't. Do you want to describe that, like this idea from Kant a bit? And what made you want to test this? I think it's so cool to bring these ideas into neuroscience. So do you want to explain a bit how that came about?
Yeah, I think this primarily came about because I've always had an interest in philosophy. So in high school, I did my A-level exams in philosophy as well. And beauty is not something that is very well studied in psychology. We're getting there, it's getting better. And I wanted to pay respects to the fact that philosophers have been thinking about beauty for 3,000 years, roundabout. And Kant, the realm of philosophy, is very well known for laying a lot of foundations for Western philosophical understanding of beauty. And so as a German native speaker, I felt very obliged to at least read this. And my supervisor was also really interested in Kant's earlier writings. From there, this idea was born that we have this one prediction Kant made that is empirically testable. So we decided we should do that to start my PhD project off. That's how it came about.
And can you explain how this, like what this study was?
Yes. So the study idea is very simple, based on Kant's statement, makes one very clear prediction. The experience of beauty requires thought, then it cannot appear if we take thought away. So our operationalization, our way of taking thought away work in an experiment was to preoccupy people's thoughts with something else. And there's a well-used task in psychological research called the NVEC task, which requires you to listen to a string of letters or numbers and then respond if a number or letter N instances back is the same as the one you're hearing right now. It sounds simple, awfully concentration consuming. I'm personally very bad at it. And so we compare participants' responses to images and other sensory stimuli when simply experiencing them as you would normal life versus experiencing them while their thoughts were preoccupied by this nasty NBEC task. And then we compared, according to Kant, right? This should, according to Kant, affect experiences that we usually dub beautiful, but it should not affect experiences that are not beautiful.
And what did you find what were the results of this study?
The results were both simple and surprising. We did find that people's experiences of beauty and pleasure were affected by having to do this task on the side, and that both pleasure and beauty were reduced. So in that sense, it appeared that there is a requirement of being able to have cognitive capacity or thoughts available to you to experience beauty. What we did not expect is that this was true for all kinds of experiences, which Kant would have not predicted. So Kant had a very distinct idea of experiences that can be beautiful, which should have been the images that were provided, and experiences that cannot be beautiful, which to him were beer, women, and food. We did not provide beer and women, but we did provide food. That suffered the same fate. So even those supposed to be not beautiful experiences suffered and became less pleasurable, less beautiful if we had to do a task on the side.
Oh, so does this mean that, because it was funny, because I would think if I was thinking of beauty, I would think there would be an ease to something that's beautiful. I don't know if you experience it, it feels like there's an ease to it. Like you just, it's relaxing, there's something to it. And I'm just thinking about this study but this kind of sounds like beauty does require like concentration. But have you had people ask, it feels that sometimes I feel like what's beautiful is when you don't have.
That question does not come up very often.
Okay.
But I've asked myself the same thing, because I take the experience of beauty as being something restorative, as something that does not feel like my brain is working so very hard. So my intuition and working hypothesis, I have not tested this yet, is that part of the experience that makes it so pleasurable is your mind, so to speak, being free. So it being preoccupied with something that is not the sensory experience, and not being able to have this moment of relaxation and free wandering of the mind prevents the pleasurable experience of beauty. And that is also something that many philosophers have considered in the experience of beauty being important. And we have self-reports for people in a different study that also confirmed this, that the feeling of the mind being able to wander freely, something that is very common and important to the experience of beauty.
Yeah, because I suppose when you're in an art gallery and you see a painting and you're really moved by the beauty of the painting, your mind has to be able to go. If you're in the gallery and you're really distracted by a lot of things, you don't have the same experience, really, do you?
Yes, and that's the intuition we really took away from this study, is that not being distracted, not being preoccupied with a specific task on the side is a prerequisite for having the experience of beauty.
I wanted your take on the first study that they talked about, based on this quote from Kant, something like beauty requires thought, and then these kind of pleasant sensory experiences don't count as beauty because they don't require thought and it's just merely pleasurable. And it seemed to me that the study that they were describing was showing basically that pleasure was actually really strongly associated with the ratings of beauty, with the yes-no answer of whether someone considered something beautiful or not, and that the more pleasurable something was, the more likely people were to say that it was beauty, and it didn't matter whether it was a so-called meaningful piece of art that the participants had brought in themselves, or if it was just like these classically used in psychology pictures that are either nice to look at or unpleasant to look at, or it was like touching a teddy bear or having candy. Like, it didn't matter the modality, and that the sensory experience and those just classic unpleasant versus pleasant shouldn't really have counted as beauty, but people still counted those experiences as beautiful. And then the second part is that then they have them do this NBAC, this distractor task, and that seems to dampen these experiences of beauty and dampens pleasure. And the conclusion seemed to be like, in some ways Kant is right, in some ways he's wrong, especially he's wrong in the fact that beauty and pleasure actually strongly overlap. because people are reporting pleasure and beauty are super correlated. What do you think? Do you think that we can make that conclusion? Because to me, it seemed like, I'm sure Kant would say it's wrong. That's not a refutation of his claim. But I do think that by definition, he's saying that those experiences can't be beautiful and that beauty is something deeper and that it's something that's not just those sensory experiences. And maybe he would say, I don't know if he would say this, but that it's something just in language that we are not specific enough when we think about beauty. We're conflating these two things. And what he's describing as beauty just doesn't match with the lay intuition of what beauty is. So what do you think about this, especially as a former philosophy major?
Minor. So take all my...
Sorry, minor.
Yes. With the grain of salt.
Don't listen to a word she says then.
I did do a class on aesthetic philosophy, which was very cool. And we did speak about this stuff. But I personally feel beauty doesn't require thinking. So I think I disagree because you know how I'm always going on about, oh, look at the flowers, look at the flowers. Like when I'm doing that, I feel that doesn't require a lot of thought at all. But maybe I don't understand what beauty is. That's why these things get so tricky. And I guess that's why the modeling's nice. Because I'm like, maybe I'm labeling that experience as beauty, but it's not. It's something else.
I don't know about the modeling part, but I think the labeling part is where the issue comes in, because I think in our vocabulary, we typically think about beauty as really similar to something like pleasure. So I think in some ways we conflate them, but then in other ways, we also have these intuitions that they're separate. So if you think about, if you describe someone, and I know that in Kant's description, women all just were sensory experiences that couldn't be beautiful. But let's say a person, it doesn't have to be a woman, but a person as they're beautiful, like their face is beautiful versus they're pretty, right? I feel like that's the idea of like the pleasure that's just immediate and not very interesting. But then when you describe someone as they have a beautiful face, I feel like there's like a depth of meaning there that goes to more maybe just depth than just immediately seeing someone as pretty. And in our first episode, which if you guys want to go for a really deep cut of Minds Matter history, we did do an episode on beauty in our first season in COVID, height of COVID. But we had talked about this model from Anjan Chatterjee of aesthetic experiences, specifically visual experiences, with these three elements. And I think he calls it a tripartite model of beauty. And one of them is this sensory motor experience of, okay, how is my body reacting to this experience? The other is emotion. So do you feel awe? Do you feel uncomfortable? And then the third part is knowledge and meaning. So that kind of brings in the context and your interpretation and what does this mean to me? What does this mean to my maybe like also cultural values? And it feels like beauty maybe requires that third part as well. And when you're running around and you're like, look at the flowers, they're so beautiful. I feel like you're also thinking about sharing that with people and thinking about the symbol of your future lab is the flower growing from the concrete. Even if you're not explicitly thinking about it, there's so much meaning behind those things that you're taking in as beautiful.
And I suppose that's so right about thinking flowers are beautiful and the meaning that they have. But then I suppose, is that not everything in life? What do we experience that doesn't have meaning? I don't know. If looking at flowers is beautiful because there's all this meaning and context behind them, I would think that's most things we find pleasurable. I don't know if I like fully commit to that, but that's one of my thoughts. So then I think I experience a lot of awe. And I think I probably maybe get that mixed up with beauty because I would think this might sound silly, but seeing a flower, I can often also get a sense of awe just because of that's nature and it creates something like this and I get to experience it and the appreciation of that. Or like when we're talking about the beaches in Australia, those of you who have experienced that, that's definitely a sense of awe. So I think my beauty and awe definition are one, and I probably put that on a lot of things because of how I interpret the world, which I suppose comes from meaning. So I guess, Ava, you're right.
I think the awe part maybe throws a wrench in what I said, because I think that's different. Because in like emotion science, there's the idea that there are like these basic emotion categories. So there's such a thing as awe, there's such a thing as anger, there's such a thing as gratitude, there's such a thing as joy. And those are completely distinct concepts that have if not a very distinct like facial pattern and brain signature, at least like a specific function. And another way of thinking about emotions is then just that there's like these basic kind of sensory feelings, like pleasant, unpleasant, and level of excitement in the body, like very drowsy or very excited with. So those kind of two dimensions, or sometimes people think there's more than those dimensions. But I think within this model, it would make more sense to think, okay, there's maybe like an arousal in the body component, like a positive negative component, but then the label, and that's like another theory of emotions as well, is that on top of those bodily sensations, you need to put on a label. And the label comes from the attributions that you're making about where this is coming from. In your case, the awe that you experience then is very much not just about you're shocked by necessarily seeing a landscape, that might be part of it, but a big part of it is the thought process behind why you're awed, right? Or like when we look up at the night sky and you see all these stars, part of the awe that we feel is, oh my God, we're so small and look at all the things that are up there and that seems impossible to contemplate. And so I think that also feels like those three dimensions of sensory motor, emotion valuation, and knowledge and meaning, like the emotion valuation and knowledge and meaning seem like a little bit tied up as well. So maybe those aren't as easy to tease apart as it feels. But I do think your experience of awe, if you're labeling that afterwards as a beautiful experience, that seems like it required some thought. If you're like, wow, this flower is so awesome, literally, because it's grown from this. Imagine the journey that it took from a little seedling. So it seems like that is something that you would also need thought. It's not just like, that's pretty.
Is there a theory of emotion that is, so you said there's basic theory of emotion and then this other theory. Is there one where everything's just on a continuum and spectrum? So you know how like it's like this is happening in psychiatry, it's, oh, there's not really these like distinct disorders, it's like things are all on spectrums, and I feel like lots of things we're learning, understanding that's more how they are. What about a theory of emotion where it's like there's all these things, maybe it's a multi-dimensional space and there's little bits of each and that contributes to the one experience?
So the theory that's about like positive, you feel these positive negative feelings in the body, you also feel arousal in the body. Those are two axes. You can picture like positive, negative as a horizontal line and then a vertical line for how excited or calm you feel. And then basically in that idea, emotions just splat somewhere on in that 2D space and they're continuous, right? So anger might be similar in some ways because it's a negative emotion to sadness, but then sadness is lower on arousal. You probably don't feel excited in your body when you're sad. But then something like jealousy might be a little bit closer to anger. So there's this idea of it being a continuum. And that's the most famous model of dimensional space. But there's obviously more important dimensions like approach and avoidance, if you're the target or the recipient of an action that causes you to feel that emotion. But definitely, I don't know if like most psychologists would see things as that space. At UCSB, there's a lot of evolutionary psychologists who I think have a more functionalist view. But I think a lot of people agree that emotions are much more like colors than actual categories. So like you have your space of wavelengths, and then we arbitrarily call some things blue, we arbitrarily call some things green, but there's a whole space in between where it's a continuous kind of fluctuation.
I reckon emotions are like colors.
I think so too. It's really hard to study though. And even though I have that belief about emotions, we often study singular emotions. And I think that kind of gets to the same question of this beauty versus sensory pleasure thing, is that maybe that is also a fuzzier boundary than we think. And if we think about the tripartite model, if it has these three elements and we have this really strong sensory motor component, then, you know, we're calling that beauty because that component is so big. And just because the other components are small, it doesn't necessarily mean that then you don't have a beautiful experience. Like, I don't know actually if Chatterjee thinks that all three of those things are necessary conditions for it to be beautiful, or if you just need a lot of one of them for you to call something a beautiful experience. But I do feel like intuitively you can call something beautiful that is not pleasant, right? Like you talked about horror movies. Maybe sometimes it's fun. If you went through a really difficult emotional experience and then you ultimately learn from it, and also you think about all the positives and negatives and you integrate those things together and that it ultimately was positive and maybe you look at it positively and then as a beautiful experience, but in the moment maybe certainly it was not pleasant. And so that seems really different, right? Two things that we would call beauty but that are so different, So I kind of see Kant's point that we should reserve maybe a word for like pretty as that first sensory experience that's just not as deep, that doesn't have that knowledge element.
I wonder if you could do an experiment to test, you know how there's the experiment in physics where light's a particle and a wave? You could do that like with emotion, because it's probably something similar. Maybe it's like what we are thinking or looking at as it is, that's what it ends up being in the experiment.
I think that's the case. And that's one of the huge issues in psychology too. And, you know, Wittgenstein said that in psychology, we have methods and we have conceptual confusion because we are not clear about what our concepts are. And that's another huge issue in psych, is that so much of it is done in English and our English boundaries really seem to carve out the world and make things seem obvious to us, but they're not, like color perception. I remember when I was in college in my first year, we had this class about, I think it was just about language, but it was about like this idea that language kind of determines how you see the world. And actually it might've started in my high school because I was in Italian class, and in Italian, there's two words for blue. There's a word for dark blue and a word for light blue, azzurro and blue. And I remember having an argument with my Italian teacher because he was like, what color is this? And I was like, oh, it's blue or something. And he was like, this is not blue. This is azzurro. And I was like, okay, that's the same thing. Like, they're literally the same color. And he was like, that's a completely different color. It's the same as green and blue. You wouldn't call it the same color. And I think they've done neuroscience studies since that the difference between light blue and dark blue and how different the pattern of representation in the brain is for Italians is the same as green and blue for us and the same as green and blue for them. Like, they're just completely separate. That makes it seem like to you that those colors are completely different. And maybe there are languages in which beauty is a completely different word. There's a completely different word for a beautiful experience, like going through something really hard and then reflecting on it and seeing that there was beauty in it, versus seeing a pretty girl or a pretty boy or something, or eating a candy.
Is there like a threshold when it's so beautiful, it doesn't really matter what's going on, it completely takes over?
It's a really good question. I would almost say that these experiences intuitively just break the mold, for we did not allow our participants to break away from the task. And in my head, that's what happened. And right, it's something that is so beautiful and so striking that distractions just don't stand a chance anymore. As the mean experimenters we are, we did not allow people to do that. We sat with them and ensured that they did the task when they were supposed to do the task.
And one of the other findings was that strong pleasure is always experienced as beauty, even when it comes from things like candy or touch. So what does that tell us about how flexible or context-dependent our experience of beauty is?
But to me, that was a really reassuring yet surprising finding, in that it confirms that beauty is a very flexible concept. It does really not depend on these categorical differences that many other Western philosophers tried to make up. And it makes sense if we think about the brain architecture that underlies experiencing pleasure. There's really nothing about it that would be bound to a particular sensory or non-sensory input. Yeah, so to me, it makes sense. To a lot of philosophers, it seems insulting. But to most artists that I talked to, that does also make a lot of sense. Mostly when I talk to creators or artists, they immediately say, yes, of course, why should there be a limit to what people can find beautiful? And I tend to agree.
Do you think that we can train what we find beautiful?
I'm just going to say, I think actually evolving into where my research started to evolve into, and it taps into this balance between familiarity and novelty that we touched on earlier. I absolutely do think that we can learn to find certain things beautiful. Anecdotally, I've experienced this myself. I went to art school before I decided to study psychology for a while. I never had much appreciation for abstract art, abstract paintings before that. I was forced into it for about 3 months and gained a real appreciation for this genre of art that by now is one of my favorites. So I think beauty is very learnable.
Yeah, we had another episode where we were, I can't remember what the topic was, but one of the discussions were if learning about something makes it more enjoyable, especially when it comes to us. So should we learn about it to enjoy it? And I think it's like such an interesting question. And I do think that it's different for different
people. So it's like if you see a movie, do you get more enjoyment if afterwards you go and talk about it with your friend? Or this is what happened, or this is what happened. Or are you someone who can just be in it and just take that away? And that's the like height of the pleasure of the experience. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think there might also be some more individual differences between the balance that people prefer between getting surprised by the experience of finding something novel in it versus preferring the feeling of something familiar and well-known that you can completely understand. I've had many arguments with friends who wanted me to tell me the content of the show we were going to see or something. And I always absolutely refuse. I want to go and just get all the novelty. But I know that for other people, that's different. And yet, it might also be a limit to how much certain people can learn when it comes to finding beauty in certain experiences. Absolutely.
Yeah, this is so cool. So now we're going to talk about your 2024 paper where you model aesthetic judgments over time. Could you explain the task design and how you use modeling in this paper?
The task design is very simple because the modeling is rather complex. So we're trying to find a balance. So basically, the only thing that people did in this task was to rate a series of images, specifically images of dogs. So the complexity here lies not in what people did. They simply had a little slider and said, okay, I like this image, not at all, to very much. The dog images, however, were created with a procedure called morphing. So we only chose 7 initial dog images, and then we created intermediary dogs that looked 30, 50, 67, 70% like the other dog in a pair. And what this allowed us to do is exactly gauge how similar and therefore how familiar images in the sequence were to one another. This was crucial because what to do in terms of modeling in this experiment is apply a reward learning algorithm to this that constantly updates people's expectations about the images they're about to see. And intuitively, without delving into the math, what the algorithm does is it gives you one number for basically what you could call familiarity. So how expected are the features of the image that you're currently seeing? And then a second number that essentially captures an aspect of novelty. And we call this aspect reward learning. And so that second estimate tries to capture how learning from the current image will improve processing of other images the participant expects to see in the next sequence. Basically, what we're trying to do in this experiment is, because we know what the participant has seen, what they likely expect to see, we can then in the sequence predict based on both the components, familiarity and expected gain in familiarity, if you want to say, how participants' ratings are going to evolve over time from one image to the next.
What did Bloom's study find?
The main finding of the study was that the model was actually not too bad at doing what it was supposed to do. And it sounds a little bit trivial, however, it's not, because we also had alternative models, so considered alternative ways of predicting participants' rating in a task. And one of them, which we took as the baseline, very importantly, was making the default psychology study assumption. So we predicted one person's rating by the average of everybody else's rating. And so that was our baseline. How well can we do if you just assume everybody gives the same answers to the same image, no matter when in the sequence the image occurs, no matter who that person is? And so the first iteration of our model that we tested against that did better allowed simply for these individual differences. What if we make separate estimates for each individual person based on a portion of their data? And that already was way better. So basically only taking familiarity into consideration, only having experiences and assuming that experiences differ between people. And then the third iteration, and that was the exciting bit for us, was finding out that taking the sequence that people experience the images in into consideration also improved our predictions. So even within those 30 minutes that participants said with the stock images, because they were so carefully constructed and only differed in controlled ways from each other, additional experience they had with the images impacted how on the sequence they rated the next upcoming ones. And it was really exciting because it also then showed that you can take something complex and subjective like beauty ratings and basically apply the same learning algorithms to this behavior that is also really good at predicting what rats are going to do in a maze, or that are really good at creating large language models and what we want to call it.
It's very cool. The model suggests that in these photos of the dog, it isn't just about the image itself, but how it helps us tune our brain's future experiences. Can you explain how this idea of aesthetic value is a learning process or kind of a learning process?
The very basic assumption that the model makes about why we would ever assign a value to a sensory experience is that having this value signal serves a greater task on the whole. That greater task being that our perceptual system does not exist in a vacuum, but exists specifically to be as good as it can be in providing us accurate information about the world. So vision is not just a carbon copy of the light that enters your eyes. It's a lot of actual processing. And the goal of that processing is to reconstruct the world in a way that is useful and accurate to us. Now, the idea of the model is that we constantly learn and train this visual system with the sensory experiences that we choose to have. And that this aesthetic value signal, fine. Oh, this is beautiful experience, serves as an indicator to ourselves that encourages us to seek out those experiences that give us the best opportunity to train this visual system to be as good as it can be.
And this is a question somebody asked me to ask, but they asked, what would be the evolution behind this kind of process? Or do you know much about how this evolved to be this way and why we selected for certain things?
So I think that question can be taken in two different ways. One of the ways I could interpret this is there an evolutionary history of the things most people find beautiful or attractive? And the other way is, why should the entire system of a human have evolved to possess something like the experience of beauty or finding sensory pleasure? I don't know which one that goes into.
Do you have maybe answers for both?
Okay, let me start with the second one. So the second question being, why should humans have evolved to possess a sense of beauty or to experience beauty? And then I think it comes down to having a sensory system, especially a visual system that functions as well as it can, is really beneficial for survival. It is mostly agreed that it's the most highly evolved sense for humans that are born sighted, and the one sense we do rely on a lot for most actions that we do. And so developing a signal that aids the system in becoming better and more accurate sounds like a pretty good deal to me. And at least that is our hypothesis, right? Really hard to prove, as with most evolutionary arguments. And so the same thing goes for the formal interpretation of the question. Are there experiences that we have over the evolutionary time courses evolved to, by and large, find more beautiful? The short answer to this is we don't know, but there are a few cases where it seems plausible. One of those cases being facial features that on average most people find attractive. So a more symmetrical, more typical face that looks young and has unblemished skin is perceived as attractive or beautiful by the vast majority of people. And that from an evolutionary standpoint might make sense, because this indicates likely that the genetic material of that person is intact and can produce good offspring. Another example of this is that most people will find images of lush landscapes that show some form of water source and a few hills and green vegetation, beautiful, highly attractive, and that in turn also at least make sense from an evolutionary standpoint, because those would be landscapes in which survival is very likely for humans. Whether that is still what predominantly drives our sense of beauty nowadays, I do not know. But there are hypotheses out there and at least some plausible arguments for at least those classes of experiences where we do agree mostly on what feels beautiful.
Yeah, because I was thinking now, I mean, there has to be so much, probably culture influences it as well. So many things would influence it. Are there, I can't work out if this is a stupid question or not. Do animals find things beautiful? They don't, they? We don't.
I like the question a lot. We don't know. There have been some experiments, even with pigeons, showing that when we often train pigeons as psychologists to selectively catch at plants or little bugs that show different shapes. That's how we check whether pigeons can learn a certain task by differentiating shapes. But if there is no differential reward, so nothing to learn about which pattern to peck on, they tend to peck on rounder shapes, which is the same preference that on average people show, that we do prefer rounder shapes over more angular shapes by and large.
Is that finding things beautiful for a pigeon?
I don't know. I really don't. And then I think in the end, the answer depends on what you are comfortable defining beauty as. So myself and a few colleagues of mine prefer to call it Occam's razor and say the simplest definition we have is it's just a highly pleasurable experience from sensory impressions. And if you take that definition of beauty, sure, why not? Any animal could have that. There's also other colleagues who argue that no, the experience of beauty has other characteristics that are different from simply being pleasurable. They do, for instance, invoke the fact that there seems to be some involvement of cognitive systems. And then you might very well argue, we have no indication that other animals or even other primates have the capacity to experience these additional cognitive involvements. And so they cannot possibly experience beauty.
Yeah.
The question's still out there.
Yeah. And with the study that we just spoke about with the photos of the dog, do you think you would get the same results if you were to use another scent? So if you were to use sound, do you think you would find that, like if you use music?
I would so love to do a study on music with this algorithm, because this very idea of beauty and pleasure evolving over time, being dependent on what came before, seems intuitively so correct for music. However, in its current form, the model that we have developed cannot deal with music yet, because it requires a meta level of expectation. So your expectation is not only dependent on what's happened before when it comes to music, but it's also dependent on your expectations of the evolution of what is coming. In theory, and intuitively, I think that model would make so much sense for music, but it's current implementation, just technically speaking, is not there yet, sadly.
This has been so cool and so interesting. I guess one other question that is, the models are amazing. Can you see these models being applied to, so can understanding someone's experience of beauty, so for example, if someone's depressed, maybe they're not seeing anything beautiful. Can you see these models one day being applied to those contexts, or is this more or not really? Or because that's what I was thinking. It's like, oh, these models are amazing and you can see all these individual differences. I wonder how they could be used to improve quality of life for people.
I really see that. I can see the positive uses and I can also see the potential avenues of these models. I think it's highly likely that we will see any form of these models, very likely a much more deep convolutional neural net transformers architecture leaning iteration of this model being employed to both do better streaming recommendations, do even more targeted advertising, but then also to provide guidance, for instance, when it comes to customization of built environments, when it comes to custom delivery of, for instance, a colleague of mine uses music to help patients with chronic pain manage the pain better. I absolutely can see this use. I think it's a question of time, how willing people are to provide the data to train these kinds of models.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, this has just been amazing. I didn't think I would have so many things to think about. Would you just like to finish by sharing with us what you're excited about that's coming up next?
I'm really mixed excited about working with new colleagues here at Liverpool Hope, and they have a lot of real-life eye tracking data.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to apply my algorithm to data that my colleagues here at Liverpool Hope has collected, which is real-time eye-tracking data of people wandering through both museums, but also installations here in the area, and use the algorithm to find out how the findings from the lab actually apply to real life.
Yeah,
that's most exciting right now.
Thank you to Dr. Anna Brielman for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is created and co-hosted by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madasuza. This episode was edited with the help of Malika Morshed and Bhumika Velanani. And you can find social media content on our Instagram at Minds Matter Podcast and TikTok at Minds Matter Pod, created this week by Ajuni Sidhu. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.